Welcome to the Begin the Begin podcast. My name is Jeff Hillemeyer, and I'm on a mission to find out what makes people tick. But not just anyone, people who are making a profound impact on the world. I want to dig into their origin story and get to the root of why and how they do what they do. I hope you are as inspired coming out of these conversations as I am. Let's get into it. On this episode, I talk with Jay Austin. He's working to interrupt mass incarceration and decarceration. We talk about what led him to this important work, the current state of mass incarceration, and the nonprofit he started called Relentless, a prison diversion and reentry program teaching premier-level videography, photography, storytelling, and other below-the-line production skills. His work is so important, and I hope you can find ways to support him on this journey. And hey, while I've got you, definitely consider subscribing on whatever platform you're listening on. I have a lot of great guests lined up that, trust me, you won't want to miss. Okay, let's get into it. All right, I'm here with my new friend, Jay. Jay, will you tell everybody who you are and what you do?
Well, how can I just in one sentence?
Not as many sentences as you want, but how about two or three, if so? I know you do a lot of things.
So I get to work with people who are interrupting mass incarceration and decarcerating the prison system with their marketing, their messaging, and their capacity building behind the scenes. And in addition to that, I'm starting a prison diversion and reentry program that I hope we get to talk about. And what we're going to be teaching to these folks is premier level videography, photography, storytelling, and other really important below the line production skills. And the whole mission of that organization is to give people the ability to change the stories around the things that perpetuate mass incarceration by literally changing the storytellers. So that's what I get to do.
I love it so much. And that's, you know, I'd never even heard decarceration before as the way that you talk about it. And so that's when we first got connected, I was like, man, I gotta hear this guy's story. Okay, we will get into it. That's the Relentless program, right? Is part of what you just mentioned. Yeah, we will definitely get into that. But hit me with some stats. Do you have stats on incarceration in this country?
Oh, there are stats. They're different stats. One of the interesting thing about the statistics with the system, though, is that the system is so disparate and disjointed, which is sometimes interesting for new people or people who are newer to this topic to hear and try to understand. Like, this seems like something that's very coordinated, but it's not. There are more than 18,000 in this country, different law enforcement agencies. Okay. And there's no real standard protocol or statistical measure or even language throughout those agencies. And it's not just laterally 18,000 plus, it's also vertically, right? We have different levels of the system. We have different lengths of the system. So the stats that I'm about to share with y'all are stats for right now, as best as we know it. Okay. So at this point in time, there is something like 2 to 2.2 million people who are currently behind bars. So what that means is that we're counting people who are in your local and county jails, your state prisons, your federal prisons, and our detention centers. And the detention centers, when I use that language right now, I'm specifically saying detention centers for people who are migrants or immigrants. Okay. So to clarify that number though, Jeff, that's as if you and I, okay, if you and I had this magical ability to multiply ourselves so that we could be in every cage in our country. And if we also had the magical ability to count every head that was in that prison or jail or detention center all at one time, there'd be something like 2 to 2.2 million people. Okay. Mm-hmm. The number is trending down, by the way. So this is good, but that still makes us as a country, the land of the free, the top incarcerator in the entire world.
Yeah.
But we still have more people.
By a large degree, right? I mean, we have what, 5-6% of the population in the world and some crazy percentage of the incarcerated people, right?
Yeah, about 20% of it.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Now, okay, let me put this in perspective even further, okay? So that was as if you and I could go everywhere all at once and count everybody in this moment. But that doesn't count how many people go in and out throughout the course of a year. And so basically on average, the number of people who are admitted into some form of incarceration in the United States every year, so in a 12-month period, is something like 5 to 6 million folks. Now, there are some people, those are individuals. Now, there are some people who go more than once. Mm-hmm. Now, when we start to count that, we're talking about churn.
Yeah, recidivism.
And now we're getting up. Yes, recidivism, absolutely. So being sent back to incarceration. Now, if we start counting the admissions like that, including the people who are returning more than once within the same time period, the same year, then we get above 10 million.
Yeah. So it's unreal. And then a high percentage a higher percentage than what our country is demographically are Black and brown people in our prisons and jails, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is one of the controversial, or I don't know if controversial is necessarily the right word for it. It's when you get into criminology, this is a talking point a lot, like how racist is the system and how expansive are we in our definition of the system? So it gets kind of muddled, but yes, if you look at the demographics behind bars right now and historically since the 1950s, the number of Black and brown folks inside of prisons is higher than the national population. So in our industry, we say they're overrepresented in the numbers.
Yeah. Right, mm-hmm. Right. And there's some stat that I've seen. It's like 1 out of every 4 Black males will end up in jail or prison at some point in their life. And maybe that's, I don't even know if that's accurate anymore. 1 out of 4, maybe it's more or less, but something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that number came out a few years ago, like 6 or 7 years ago. And at the time it was 1 in 3.
1 in 3. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what I love about what you're doing, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time focused on this issue in particular. However, I did read Just Mercy and I got to meet Brian Stevenson once. And
very cool.
That whole, I mean, if anybody hasn't read that book or listened to it, I mean, do that before watching the movie. But you know, he focuses more people on death row, but in there you start to see some of the things you just shared. So I've seen that, but where I have focused more of my time is on people experiencing homelessness. And I think it's a very similar issue in many senses. Certainly there are systemic parts of our society that keep these people down and keep them on the streets. And we need to fix that. And I've seen some of the stuff you've written and talked about in terms of the systemic reasons why incarceration is so high. But what I love about what you're doing is I often say that to me, the biggest thing hindering progress with people experiencing homelessness is the storytelling, which then leads to the empathy. I find that when a human being can feel like they can put themselves in the shoes of someone suffering, oftentimes they will take a deeper look at that and become a supporter of the cause. You see that with cancer, for instance. You know, you have someone in your family who has cancer and suddenly you feel compelled to get involved. Homelessness and incarcerated people, it's really hard to have somebody be able to hear or experience something that gets them in that frame of mind. So as you talk about storytelling, I just think that's so on point for what needs to happen. And the idea that you're working with people who have gone through this to tell their stories, to affect the storytelling, I just think that's phenomenal.
Thank you. Thank you. So how do you think that we develop more empathy through better storytelling around something like homelessness, for example?
Well, I wish I had the answer, but I do think the times I've seen people's hearts change the most is when they can actually meet and speak to and get to know someone who is homeless or has experienced homelessness or who is on the fringe, because you start to see that they're human being. It's so easy to drive past somebody holding a sign and not have to think about it. But when I've seen someone actually sit and have a conversation, so the more that I think they can personally tell their stories, I think the better. Then there's also the aspect of storytelling that's like through the media. I'm a big believer that you cannot be a white adult in this country and not be racist in some part of your body, because you have grown up seeing the news, seeing movies, seeing TV shows where Black people by and large are the criminal or doing the bad act. And so to think that you can get through that without, so the storytelling also impacts the media. And so the more you can have creators showing, you know, the good guy who's a person of color, for instance, or the person who was wrongly convicted, who gets, I just think that all that sort of weaves together. What do you think?
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective on it, because, you know, when I think about communicating stories about homelessness, one of the things that I think makes it so nuanced and interesting to explore is that homelessness is not that far away from any of us. And I think when, you know, you and I are in Atlanta, so when we stop at a stoplight in certain parts of the city, the folks just don't stand on the curbs. They'll walk in the streets past your cars. And I remember the first time that I saw that, I wasn't in the United States. I was in a developing country, and that was their business. That's what they did. You know, they would move up and down the streets at stop signs and stoplights to do that. And the first time I saw it in the United States was here in Atlanta. And I was thinking to myself, wow, look at people diverting their eyes, including me. Right? So yes, we could give them our change, our money, our whatever, whatever food we have that we just bought from a Whole Foods or whatever. Or we could look at them in the eye and throw them a peace sign. And it's debatable about which one matters more or less in that moment to that person. But I got to thinking, what makes it so difficult to look that person in the face and just show them a small gesture of, hey, I see you. And I do think it's because at one point in time, like, our ancestors were homeless, right? Even if nobody in our like past 3-5 generations have experienced something like that, you know, where it's so visible and visceral, like, we've all at some point in time experienced that. And as a culture, we have worked so hard to make that not be a reality. Yeah. And we still can't figure it out. And a lot of the systems that we built to make sure that we're in houses have excluded others from being in houses, you know, and that's a whole another conversation on the side. But I think, like, with the homelessness thing, it's hard to look at because we could actually see us in that. There's something deep, deep, deep inside of us that doesn't want to admit that we could be that, especially when we aren't dealing with any sort of situation that we think that person might be dealing with, or the story that we're telling ourselves about them, yes. Right? Like, so substance abuse or anything like that. But really, like, in the United States, we're so wealthy. One of the top reasons why people become homeless, even if it's for a short amount of time, is debt, especially medical debt. Okay. You and I could get sick at any point in time. And if the insurance doesn't cover it, even for a short amount of time, like, we're there. And so I think there's something just innate in us that builds that wall that maybe doesn't exist with mass incarceration, but should.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. There's Terrence Lester. I don't know if you've gotten to know Terrence.
No, not yet.
Into Atlanta. So he has Love Beyond Walls. It's an organization that fights on behalf of people experiencing homelessness and who are in poverty. And he created the first of its kind museum dedicated to homeless people. And It's called the Dignity Museum. And one of the things that you do is, as you go through it, there's a station you stop at where you literally create, you write on a piece of cardboard what you would have to hold up in front of people if you were homeless, if you were on the street, if you were begging for food, right? And that was like, I can remember doing it. Like, it was the first time I really put myself in that place and said, my gosh, if I had kids I had to take care of and I needed to beg for money, what would I write on this sign to get people to actually pay attention to me? And it's made me now, you know, really look and read what people do write. That powerful moment really affected me. And so, like, again, I think that I just think the answer is empathy, you know, and I think storytelling is a big part of it. But again, that's why I go back to what you're doing. And I guess I'd take a few steps back and ask, where did the empathy for this cause come from in you?
Yeah, because I got wrapped up in it. And I grew up in neighborhoods that were totally wrapped up in it. But it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s and I was running a video production company out in Kansas City, Missouri. And one of the things that we were working on a story about why our neighborhood was the way it was compared to somebody else's hood. And as part of that research, I got to read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander.
Yeah. I love that. That's actually, I think, the first book I read about, this was probably 10 or 15 years ago, about this stuff. And it just, blew me away.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Because it's so compelling. I mean, there are few works that are as compelling about a divisive topic such as that one. Right. And so I read that, and Jeff, the best way to describe it was that reading that book was a lot like a fish learning that it was wet.
Yeah.
You just didn't know it. You didn't know it. Now, one of the inspirational pieces that I got from that book was, well, there were two things. One, wow, she crafted something entirely compelling, not just to people who she already knew would believe it, but to people who are entirely new to the topic. So I took lessons from that. It was just masterful. So shout out to Michelle Alexander and whoever edited that book.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. Now, the second thing that I took from it was that so much of what she talked about was systemic. And what's really cool about systems is, as gnarly as they are, we understand how interventions work. And so when I saw that my ocean had kind of been created for me and perpetuated a lot of times by the people in it, just because we would never leave, you know, I realized that there was actually something I could do. There were many things I could do that were not overwhelming, that were practical, that would take work, but at their core were simple interventions. Yeah. So I love that book. And that was what really got me on that journey of thinking about, well, what would happen if we changed the storytellers?
But so why did you read the book though? You read the book because you were working on this particular project or because,
yeah.
Okay, got it. Cause that's the thing. Like I feel like my change came through an experience I went through with Leadership Atlanta, which is a program in Atlanta I hope you consider going through now that you're here. Sure. But it was, I loved how you said it, like a fish learning it was wet. Like that's what happened to me. My eyes, like the aperture just opened up and I was like,
yeah,
I can't believe the amount of privilege that I have. And I just didn't know it. And then I started to research, and that's when I read The New Jim Crow and Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and all these books that just like kept opening my eyes. But I often say, like, especially for white guys, I kind of wish we could all have that experience where we see, and white people in general, but I think white males tend to not want to see these things in my experience until they're forced to. And so everyone can't go through Leadership Atlanta. Everyone can't work in or live in a community you were living in. And so that's like part of why I still love your idea of storytelling, is because I just think the more that we can see humans at that level, the more, and really the way the world is today and has been, the more we'll be compelled to fight against it. I just think there's not enough of that. So that's why I was curious of sort of how you got to that point of even reading The New Jim Crow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so my partner on that project is still a very close friend, and we're working on Relentless together. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he's a documentarian. He's a producer. He's out in LA, is my brother, Nico. And it was like that for both of us, because both of us had lived really cool upbringings where we grew up in those situations, but had developed the skills and were given the opportunities to leave those environments and just see what was out there with someone alongside of us telling us that we could operate out here and not have to change who we are. So that was a really big deal for us. And so I think we were kind of primed for content like The New Jim Crow. But, you know, so the very moment that I came up with the idea for, you know, changing the storytellers, right, which is not a novel idea, it just happened to be novel to me at that time. We were in our studio in the Arts District in Kansas City. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, right? Like we were doing all the things that young creators do at 2 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday. And it's not just editing. Okay. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking about the project and I'm looking at my studio, and we had about six of our crew members in there at the time. And I love those folks, but I was looking at them and I was thinking, you know, the way that they got their first kit, right, their first camera kit, was they were watching YouTube. They saw somebody on YouTube who was running gun shooting. They were like, oh, I can do that. And so they swiped the mom's credit card. They dropped $1,500 and then they just ran around, started shooting. And I was like, that never would have happened where I'm from. Never, ever. But if it did, Oh my goodness. Could you think about the way that we could transform our trauma into the most compelling stories about this that you've ever heard? And so that's when I wrote down in my ideas notebook, what eventually became Relentless.
And talk about Relentless. That's part of what I was so excited you were bringing to Atlanta when you moved in. How long have you been in the city?
4 weeks.
4 weeks. Yeah. You're brand new.
I'm brand new, man.
talk about Relentless. I think that's, it's so exciting.
Yeah. So what I really hope that we can accomplish is create messaging that changes the narrative around the things that perpetuate mass incarceration by changing the storytellers. And that's my outside pitch, but because you and I are inside right now, what I'm hoping happens even more than that is that the creators in our organization, so these are people who are being diverted from the system or who are reentering from prison. My hope is that these creators with a capital C begin to change the stories that they've told about themselves. That's the real mission there. Because we do tell ourselves these stories. And so, you know, when I listen to you talk about being a white dude trying to explore these things, it's not just y'all who need to hear these messages, it's us. So can I share a quick story about this? So this isn't the first time I've been to Atlanta. I actually came down right after the elections in 2020 to do a couple things. I took a road trip through 11 different cities throughout the South to sit and listen to people talk about their feelings about the election. And these were all people working in criminal justice reform. So I hit everybody on the spectrum. So that was eye-opening. But then I got down to Atlanta and I found a studio. That was my goal. Okay. Now, while I was down here, I was also exploring different neighborhoods that I would potentially want to live in. And one of the neighborhoods that was right nearby the studio that we eventually picked is called Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh felt like home, but not because it felt safe. You know what I mean? It felt like where I grew up. And it felt like at this point in my life, doing the work that I'm getting to do now, especially down here in the A, I wanted to stay close to that feeling that I had. And so we decided to move into Pittsburgh. Now, fast forward a year or so, and I'm out in the streets in Pittsburgh taking photos. I'm right across the street from one of those all-American package stores, so a liquor store, right? And I'm just at an intersection, and I'm walking with my camera, taking shots, cars busy, loud, people on the streets, people canvassing for voter registration and different mayoral candidates and stuff like that, because it's election season here. And this OG was outside of like an auto parts store. And he's opening the door and he's getting into his like cream Escalade with the rims on it, right? And he sees me. He's kind of up on this hill and I'm walking through the grass with my camera taking shots. And he looks at me, he goes, "Hey, be safe out here." Right? Now, when you come from where I come from, that is a phrase that can mean multiple things, right? When somebody tells you be safe, it could be a gift that they're giving you. It could be advice, or it could be kind of like this warning, and a warning in two ways. One, make sure you know where you're at. But then two, it can also be said in a hostile way, like you need to be safe around me, period. And so in that moment, it was a strange thing because he didn't know where I was from. He just knew that I was new to the hood. Yep. And so he was giving me this piece of advice about a neighborhood that wasn't always like this. And the meaning of that phrase had changed for him in his own lifetime. And I was thinking to myself, so what happens when I tell others to be safe? Like that. Is that a narrative that is perpetuating and creating a reality around me by telling someone, be safe out there, be careful, which is a lot of times like that's how you can tell where people are from. If you end a conversation by saying, be safe, that's a signal about where they're from, right? It's not like, okay, I'll see you next time, because that implies that there's a future. Okay. So I get to toy with this and I'm like, wow. How much of the unsafety are we perpetuating only in our minds like that? So When I say that Relentless is something where I want it to be a place where people can change the stories that are told about all of it in general, I really want it to start with them as well.
Yeah. That's, that just, to me, that just tells me where your heart is with this. The idea that yes, you want to change the storytellers, but also so that as they tell these stories, it changes them inside. And, and that's so amazing.
Thank you.
So you're 4 weeks into Atlanta, you're bringing Relentless here. What's the next 6 to 12 months look like? And then how can people get involved?
Sure. Okay. So specifically with Relentless, we are a fiscally sponsored project at this point, which means that we can take any sort of contribution that anybody wants to contribute, whether it's time, talent, money, or equipment. And trust me, I will accept all of it. And I've got things for you to do. And eventually over the next 6 months, I want to transition Relentless into its own 501c3 organization. And to do that, I need to put together a board. And so that's my main focus with Relentless right now, is figuring out exactly how to put the board together. Half of our board is going to be medical professionals, because despite all the glitz and glam of the actual program itself, we're going to be working with people who have experienced some crazy shit. And I want to be able to deliver high quality options and opportunities for healthcare and support, even without them knowing it sometimes. So that's my focus right now, is putting together my board. But next year, so 6 months puts us into 2022. The goal is to have the studio set up by April of next year, and have our first cohort by the end of next year. And the thing that could help us bring that cohort together is financial contributions, so we can get our equipment, and pay our mentors who are going to be working with our creators as they come in. But even more importantly than that, partners who are interested in allowing our creators to practice on them and their brand as they rapidly develop their videography, photography, storytelling skills. And to make it juicy for those partners, one of the things that we're doing is, if you sign up as a partner and allow our creators to shoot at you, as soon as you like the content, you can buy that content from that creator, promoting and perpetuating ownership among these folks who have had everything taken away from them. So that's what I'm focused on right now for Relentless.
Awesome. I love it. We're going to put links in the show notes for anyone who wants to get in touch and help with that. And man, I'm so glad we got connected. We'll have lots more conversations, but I love the work that you're doing. And again, like you study this space more than me, but I think you're attacking it from such an important aspect. So thanks for all you're doing, Jay. And thanks for joining me today.
Yeah. Thanks for the platform, Jeff.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Wow, you made it to the end of the podcast. I didn't think people did that anymore. Well, since I still have you, I'd love for you to do two things. First, subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you're listening on. That way you'll be alerted as soon as I post my next one. And second, I'd love for you to subscribe to my email newsletter. I send out an email every week or two, and it's really where I share my more personal thoughts and ideas. Plus, I give stuff away sometimes. You can find the sign up at my blog, jeffhillemeyer.com. And I really do appreciate you listening.